Hi, everybody. It's Andrew Langer, President of the Institute for Liberty with the IFL podcast. It is the 10th of November, and we've got, as usual, an extra special guest. Once again, we're going to be interviewing my father, Professor Arthur M. Langer. Dad, say hi.
Hi, out there to the listening audience.
Great. We're going to be talking about chemical risk issues today, comparative risk assessment in very, very general terms, but really focusing on a specific chemical or chemical class, I suppose, is probably the better way to put it, right, Deb?
Yes.
Yep. Phthalates, spelled P-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. I had to close my eyes and think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
Phthalates, which are plasticizers. Really, what we're talking about more fundamentally, though, is this problem of making public policy without regards to actual risk and without regards to actual comparative risk, sort of a fundamental issue of policymaking. Now, those of you who know me know that that this is an issue near and dear to my heart, and the reason is, or one of the reasons why, is because I learned this from my father sitting around the kitchen table. A lot of you have heard me tell the story before, but really my interest in comparative risk assessment as a tool for crafting public policy comes from my dad. And let's start off, Pop. Why don't you tell us all a little bit about risk assessment, the assessment of risk, and the comparison of risk, and why it's so important in public policy making?
You're going to shift the responsibility for all of your notions to me.
Yes, of course. isn't that the way we do it in America today?
Sure, certainly. All right, let's begin at the beginning. The class of compounds you're interested in are phthalates. Phthalates are very similar in conceptual classification as compounds like PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. There isn't one, but there are hundreds of isomeric varieties. Furans, again, plural, dioxin, make that plural. It's only certain forms of these complex molecules and compounds that are toxic and others that aren't, or at least show very little toxicity in various systems, various experimental systems. In terms of phthalates, what do we know about it? The last document that I have found was published in 2000, the year 2000. It is the International Agency for Research on Cancer's monograph. The monograph series is the evaluation of carcinogenic risks to humans. And in volume 77, which I have on my desk now, the subject of this monograph is some industrial chemicals. And one of the industrial chemicals that is evaluated in this monograph, and these evaluations are made by internationally recognized experts who have contributed in these areas, the phthalate, which is evaluated, is a single phthalate, and there are many compounds in the 1970s. There were about 20 such compounds that were used in plastics to stabilize plastics and to impart specific properties to the plastics. This material is a diethyl hexyl phthalate. It's a very complex molecule.
Let me just stop you there for a second, and let's talk about the use of these things for a moment and the era in which they were introduced. Now, these are compounds that are used to make plastics softer. There are a lot of folks out there who don't remember that back before 1980 or so, you had plastics that were very brittle and very hard and could shatter very easily, right?
That is correct.
And so when you're talking about trying to use things, let's specifically look at products for babies, because a lot of these plasticizers are used in baby products, baby toys, baby bottles, et cetera. Now, when I was a kid, they had glass baby bottles. Well, I guess they had plastic when I was a kid, but before then, there were glass baby bottles.
That's correct.
And so you're talking about things that could get thrown and can get smashed, and you would have shards and you would have jagged edges, right?
Absolutely correct, yes.
These things were introduced because there was a need for a baby bottle and baby products that could be dropped from 3-4 feet high and wouldn't shatter, and stuff that could be smashed against a high chair and wouldn't
correct.
Get shattered. Okay. So there was a definite, there and there remains a definite public need for this. Now, we don't have the data, at hand on the incidence of injury from plastic and glass shards. They weren't collecting a lot of that data, but certainly it was all too common occurrence, right?
Yes, it was, but you're talking about consequences of substitution. In many instances, substitution of one product for another, and put the quotes around it, a safer product, is embraced by society. However, once in a while, a product is introduced that may come with its own set of unintended consequences and issues. Now, the plasticizers, looking at data from the year 2000, and interestingly, I pulled out some of my earlier documents of visiting Bob Rubin down at Johns Hopkins, who was in the Department of Environmental Medicine at Hopkins in 1972. Maybe it was 1971 even. It's that long ago. But the original studies that were done in Rubin's laboratory in conjunction with Dr. Yeager, who was his colleague, the glycol phthalate was found in polyvinyl chloride tubing following an experiment when new instruments were being evaluated in the laboratory, gas chromatography with mass spectroscopy, able to detect minuscule concentrations of these molecules. And so it was found that this particular phthalate was found contaminating a product from PVC tubing. However, when the same experiment was run using latex tubing, this compound wasn't found, or when the experiment was run with glass tubing, this compound was not found. And it was Rubin who discovered that the leaching from PVC plastic of the diethylhexyl phthalate. It's a complex molecule.
Yes.
This experiment was followed by looking at a number of other products, and it was found that some of these phthalates leached from the plastic storage bags, medical devices, and so on, that came from plastics in which this compound was used to modify properties, strengthen the plastic, render it flexible with greater uses, and so on and so forth. But even then, let's say in 1972, at the Pinehurst Conference down in North Carolina, there was no evidence that there was any harm to humans. Now, that was followed up 28 years later with the IARC monograph, in which the evidence for human carcinogenicity was also lacking. When these compounds are evaluated, the bottom line was that there was inadequate evidence in humans for the carcinogenicity of this particular plasticizer, the diethylhexyl phthalate, although there was evidence of carcinogenicity in laboratory animals.
Yes.
But this monograph stated that when you look at the animal data, the animal models and the effects in the animal were never found in human populations. So it was considered to be specific to a mammalian intact animal, but nonspecific and not indicative of carcinogenicity in humans.
And see, this gets to sort of my this fundamental issue with it. Now, this all is coming to a head nowadays because of the passage a few years back of the Consumer Product Safety Improvements Act and the subsequent regulations that have come out to support that. It's this issue of context. Now, you talk about the leaching of the complex phthalate chemical, out of PVC piping or what have you. And in the abstract, it sounds alarming, until you sort of get down to and you conceive of the fact that there's stuff leaching into things all the time. And it is a matter of this dose-response relationship, the duration, et cetera, in terms of determining the risk of harm to you. Isn't that right?
It's correct. Listen, if we look at the entire field of phthalate chemistry and compounds, and you look at the reports in various times and various places, phthalates have been found in foods as naturally occurring compounds. I mean, it's found in grapes and cranberries and in olive oil. It's found in corn oil. Phthalates have been found in the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico and so on and so forth. It's like small amounts of asbestos in ambient air.
Yes.
There is a natural burden, and it's out there. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to recommend everyone go into an asbestos textile mill and feel safe to be exposed. However, we're dealing with issues involving the perception of safety, the perception of risk, and whether we have information concerning dose-response relationships, and the concept of comparative risks.
Yes.
Now, there may be, and Andrew, I think you remember this, we had a neighbor who used to worry about every issue popping up on the 5 o'clock news on television. And
of course,
she would call me and ask whether it's safe to allow her kids to eat apples because of ALAR. And people make judgments. Scientists present the data. And individuals and societies and groups within society make their own judgment calls. The phthalate issue has probably been overblown.
Sure.
However, people with babies may wish to err on the side of safety and use glass bottles. If that's what they wish, then let them go ahead and do it.
Sure.
Whether we should continue to use plastics in automobiles in various kinds, it seems perfectly reasonable to me. The exposures are trivial. The risks to adults are trivial, and I would recommend continual use of this or continuing use of these materials. When it comes to babies and bottles and other issues like that, that's a different call. That is a call that if the Consumer Product Safety Commission wishes to curtail the use of certain plastics with plasticizers, specifically phthalates, let them make that call. But are there data to support it? Well, it's an error on the side of safety.
Well, but of course,
pardon?
But again, there should be this consumer choice. I mean, if someone wants that, because you are, as we were talking about earlier, there is this issue of the substitution issue. So you're taking one set of risks, a minute set of risks in terms of, and we've got now 25, almost, well, more than 20, 30 years of data, or at least we should, that point to no real risk from the phthalates in the baby bottles, whereas, you're substituting that minute risk for the risk of harm from something else that might happen with the bottles.
Well, this is true. I think the problem is the conception the perception by the public regarding a word, safety.
Yes.
That is, people want absolute safety, and absolute safety does not exist.
There you go.
Safety is, when you compare it with other risks, which are assumed by those who get out of bed in the morning and go to work or do whatever they do, there's increased risk of an untoward outcome.
Yes.
Absolute safety does not exist. Risk exists by living. And the risk magnitudes are very, very different. I think that you remember me telling you about that a gentleman in New York City who was killed by a bicycle emerging from a restaurant.
And I believe we've actually talked about that on our podcast before.
Well, this is this risk existed, but everyone sensible people, might not consider it when they're going out to dinner in New York City.
Sure.
What is my risk of being struck and killed by a bicycle after I have dinner at some restaurant, or before I had dinner in some restaurant? It is a measurable risk. It's a real risk, but no one would ever consider it. However, let's take a baby. And a baby has no ability to distinguish among these risks as to what is acceptable to this individual and what is unacceptable. So the parent makes that decision, and if the parent doesn't have the science and doesn't have the wherewithal or the information to make a reasonable decision, then it may be left up to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. But the Consumer Product Safety Commission will look at different products with different phthalates and come to very different conclusions regarding risks and those portions of the population that come into contact with these products, and therefore they will evaluate each and every one of these products differently. Do I think that there's a risk with glass bottles? Certainly, of course.
Yeah.
Do I think that this risk may be greater than phthalates and plastics? It depends on the phthalate. There are, at least in the 1970s, 20-some-odd phthalic acid esters, PAEs, that were used in plasticizers. Only one of these has ever been evaluated that was considered to be remotely important in terms of carcinogenicity.
And in it wasn't found in humans. It was found in studies of rats.
Studies of animals.
Yeah.
Not in humans, but of course the caveat raised with the human population study. This is a working population actually manufactured these compounds, exposed to very high concentrations of these compounds 8 hours a day over a working day, over a working year, over a working lifetime. The population in this chemical plant was a small population, and therefore the epidemiologists who evaluated this study claimed that because of the number of workers, there wasn't adequate power to detect a potential excess risk. So that, for example, if you're doing an animal study and you think that you have found one cancer in 100 animals in your experiment, if you look at the statistical tables, this might represent upwards of 4.5% carcinogenicity. But you need 100 animals in the experiment to reach that conclusion. Now, 4.5% is not a very good number if you're interested in carcinogenicity and compounds and the various studies. So you have to look at larger studies. Do meta-analysis with multiple cohorts to come up to some statistical power as to what the actual risks are. Nevertheless, the good news is that it's not obvious.
Yes.
There are no data to label this particular phthalate as a the diethylhexyl phthalate to regard it as a human carcinogen. That's the good news. The bad news is, well, who knows? In 20 years, we may find out something that's different, but at least we're being reassured that 38 years or 38 years of widespread use of consuming 350 million pounds of these plasticizers per year, that there's no obvious data set to implicate these compounds as human carcinogens.
And certainly what it all underscores is that if the as the CPSC takes up these issues of, you know, public policy courses of action based upon risk assessment, that it's clear that the Office of Management and Budget has to come out with their comprehensive comparative risk assessment guidelines and extend those guidelines to independent agencies like the CPSC.
I understand, sure.
Yeah.
But that's a lot more difficult issue than appears on the surface. You're dealing with materials in different matrices, materials that leach at different rates.
Sure.
That leach in different media. If it's water, it behaves differently than in some other medium, such as human serum.
Yeah.
The compounds behave quite differently, and the differential in toxicity is very great in these compounds. So those that have been most used and most active have been tested, and in terms of carcinogenic effects, there's not much to go on, which is reassuring. Although there are studies with different compounds that have shown cellular toxicity, and some of these compounds are mutagenic in their test systems,
yeah.
Teratogenic. Creating these genetic anomalies in various types, their reproductive effects that have been studied, and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is that when all of these data are evaluated, human carcinogenicity is not at the forefront.
All right, let me ask you one more thing before we go, real quick.
Yeah.
Part and parcel of this Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act has been a move to severely restrict the resale of old used books, books in which the inks contain trace amounts of lead, and there's a huge market for books that, you know, folks want to buy from their childhood, from their parents' childhood, et cetera. Your thoughts on this move to essentially ban these books?
Oh, it's essentially mindless.
In the most literal sense.
Well, I mean, some of the stuff that I have looked at includes the effects of, for example, lead on the decrements measured in IQs. Now, on different days, you could take the same person and have more variability in IQ tests than is propounded by some of these studies involving lead and effects on the central nervous system, on cognitive skills, and so on and so forth. This is really mindless. I mean, that we could look at lots of things and find some aberration, some toxin present at trace levels, which have been shown in the in the occupational, in the heavy exposed individuals to have effects.
Yeah, one would think that the librarians would be especially susceptible to this.
Well, yeah, I suppose librarians or instructors or teachers or whatever. Would it be possible that there would be some profound effect with the various metals in inks? I don't think so. Gee, we proposed doing a study on cellulose and the cellulose that had been recycled.
Interesting.
And blown into spaces for insulation purposes. But this is just crazy. It has gone beyond the pale.
And I guess this is the whole point of all this, is that we have to get to some rationality in determining, assessing risk, and B, in comparing risk, and then C, divining public policy from this and recognizing that what you said is absolutely true. We do not live in a risk-free world, that absolute safety is an impossibility.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, listen, Dad, thank you very, very much for coming out and doing this for us today. Again, this is Andrew Langer. This is my father's Professor Arthur M. Langer. And we look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Look forward.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.